My mom's legal proxies delivered the order to the hospital staff. And then we all gathered around her, holding her and telling her we loved her as she died. This was only a year and a half after we'd done the same with my beloved Nana, my mom's mom. It was horrible. The pain of loss, my own guilt over not coming back to see my mom sooner when she first told me about her extended cold, the angry sense of unfairness in having two people I loved so dearly taken away from me so close together. But unlike Dean, we had the advantage that my mother had planned for her death. She had an advance directive. She had a will. She had my sister and her sister assigned as executors. And she had told me more than once what she wanted to happen to her body when she died, that she wanted to be cremated, and that she wanted her ashes scattered along her favorite spot at her favorite lake. When we lived by The Art of Dying Well by Katie Butler, Dean and I recalled our own stories of loss. We thought about what we considered a good death. We discussed what we wanted to have done with our own bodies when we die. We completed some important paperwork. And we talked about what we wanted our legacies to be. Both of us said we wanted the kindness we've shared with others to live on. In Jolenta's case, living by The Art of Dying Well was quite different. It wasn't about focusing on losses she'd experienced, but about confronting the fact that her parents would someday die. This meant having important conversations. Conversations that, in the end, were reassuring. While she was talking with her mom, it came to light that there was already end-of-life paperwork in order. It also became clear that Jolenta's mother wasn't afraid to ask for help, and in fact, already had a team of people she relied on for her needs, including, to Jolenta's relief, an attorney. In addition to beginning the process of considering her parents' deaths, Jolenta also began considering her own death and what a good death would mean to her. She realized that she wanted an animal in the room with her when she died. She decided on a book passage she wanted read out loud to her in the end, and she talked at length with her husband about what quality of life meant to each of them. In the end, both Jolenta and I felt better after living by Katie Butler's book. Jolenta felt less afraid. I felt more prepared. And overall, we both felt a little more in touch with the reality of death, as well as what we value most in life.
Dear Kristen and Jolenta, just hearing the word death makes me sad. Like, seriously, I go into a panic when I think about death. MB. Dear MB, I feel you. I'm in the same boat. I normally try to avoid confronting the idea of mortality at all costs. I even tried to back out of living by the one and only book about death that we covered on By the Book. I'm never going to tell you to do anything you know will trigger you or make you needlessly sad, but I can say that my experience with getting uncomfortable and exploring what death means to me also helped me explore what life means to me. And that was a wonderful experience. I went from totally avoiding the subject to realizing that I was more afraid of the unknown than of anything else. And really, aren't we all? But the more I got to know the unknown and define what it meant to me, the less scary the idea of death became in general. Through planning for my death, I ended up having wonderful conversations with my family. I got a rare chance to carefully explore what I find wonderful, where my priorities are right now, and to connect with the people I love. So, that wasn't too scary. Jolenta. Part 2. 8 Things That Didn't Work. Wake up early. I'm not a morning person. At all. You could say early mornings and I are mortal enemies. And the same goes for Kristen. Sadly, our society isn't very encouraging towards those of us who don't like early morning wake-up calls. Most of our prescribed daily routines, like when we have to go to work and school, begin early and celebrate those who naturally start their days at the crack of dawn. Because of this fact, I've always wanted to fix my aversion towards mornings and learn how to become an early riser. I had high hopes that a book we lived by called The Miracle Morning was going to finally teach me how to properly seize the day before noon. The author, Hal Elrod, posits that 95% of us are mediocre, unlike the top 5% of people, based on what statistics, I don't know. Most of us won't retire comfortably, are overweight, and are headed for divorce if not already there. But we don't have to stay that way. We can have it all. All we have to do is choose to learn, grow, and be a little better each day by taking an hour or two every morning to write, sit in silence, exercise, list affirmations, and visualize what we want out of life. Truly, that is it. Get up early and do a handful of generic wellness activities, and you'll be as successful as Cher selling the first affordable tickets to vacation on the moon. This sounded incredibly doable, and all I want to do ever is stop being mediocre. So after reading the book, I set my alarm for 7 o'clock the next morning instead of my usual 9 a.m., and got to work, or should I say sleep. As I drifted off into dreamland, I fantasized about all the things I'd get done in my early mornings. I was finally going to write that 30-minute comedy set. I was going to become mindful because I would finally have time to sit in silence. It was going to be great. But the work of being early to rise didn't go smoothly. No matter how early I tried going to sleep, Brad had to wrestle me out of bed in the morning because I would sleep through my early alarm. When I finally did wake up, every activity was torture. Sitting in silence wasn't possible. No matter how I tried, I kept falling right back asleep. One morning, I started nodding off during my silent time and woke up to my hair on fire. I had lit a candle for ambiance and managed to dip my hair in it as I passed out. I was fine, just a few crispy, smelly, burned ends on a little chunk of tresses. While I wasn't injured, I was sorely disappointed. Starting my day with the smell of burning hair didn't leave me feeling miraculous. By the end of the first week, I was a mess. I was totally sleep-deprived and underperforming in every area of my life. I was lackluster at work and in the sack. And eventually, I just got sick, retired to my bed, and gave up on living by the book. After a week of sleeping, coughing, and blowing my nose nonstop, I'd finally recovered from living by the miracle morning. And I'm here to tell you, it didn't work for me. Which sucks, because Hal Elrod basically promised me it was the one surefire way to get my life in order and start being more productive. It's almost as if one scheduling hack really blew a dude's mind and he decided to build a whole brand around it before checking to see if it was universally true, which most things aren't, except like gravity. Waking up early made me far more mediocre than I was when I got up at my usual time. And even though she didn't get sick, Kristen also hated getting up early. She struggled to stay awake and had many late-night work events that made getting up early almost impossible. Eventually, she gave up too. And I don't blame her. She already had what I would consider to be the perfect morning routine. Her husband, Dean, wakes her up as late as possible by rubbing her feet. And then she tosses on some makeup and runs out the door. Why mess with what works? Kristen is definitely not mediocre. So maybe getting up early to do some randomly prescribed wellness-related activities has no bearing on how successful you are. I've learned this the hard way. You can't fight your internal clock. Sleep is necessary, and you can't hack it or bypass it too much without ceasing to function properly. I think everyone has a miracle hour, that 1 hour or two a day when you always seem to crank out your best work and deepest thoughts with ease. That hour is probably around 6 a.m. for Hal Elrod, and that's why he thinks getting up early is the best way to be productive. But there's no one time that's best for everyone. Who really cares if you like centering yourself or being productive at midnight, noon, or 4 p.m.? The time doesn't matter. Now quit worrying about how to optimize your morning and go back to bed.
Dear Kristen and Jolenta, I understand that you don't personally enjoy waking up early, but waking up early really and truly does work if you're willing to do it. Why do you think so many high schools start their day at 8 a.m.? Why do so many gyms have yoga classes at 6 a.m.? Why is the U.S. Army's motto, "We do more before 9 a.m. than most people do all day"? Because starting the day early means getting more done. I speak from experience as someone who rises at 5 a.m. each day. ER. Dear ER, we totally believe you when you say that waking up early helps you get more done. Congratulations on finding something that works for you. Unfortunately, the same is not true for us. Jolenta and I have found that our energy levels are not especially high in the mornings. We don't produce more work or get more done just because we're up earlier. If anything, we're grouchier and more exhausted and more susceptible to illness. That being said, we get plenty done when we do eventually get out of bed. We write and host our two podcasts. Jolenta does stand-up and storytelling shows and also has a full career as a voiceover artist. I teach classes and consult companies that want to start podcasts and host other podcasts. And until last year, I headed up a whole department of a podcasting company. We work a lot and we get a lot done. Look, we're writing a book right now. But we understand why some people feel that early risers get more done. The fact is, the world is set up for them, as you yourself have pointed out, ER. This means that people who love waking up early have the advantage of being able to go to school and fitness centers at an hour that feels good to them. It means they can be productive when the world tells them they should be productive, rather than at 10 p.m. when Jolenta and I are often typing away. Enjoy your early hours, ER. Enjoy that the world is set up for you. Get everything done that you want to. Jolenta and I will get our work done later tonight when you're fast asleep. Kristen. Meditate. Friends, before you insist that I absolutely must meditate, that it's scientifically proven that all people should, that I don't know what I'm missing, that I'm probably not the best version of myself because I don't meditate, let me just get this out of the way. You are more than free to enjoy meditation, and I'm not ever going to try to stop you from doing it. If that's what you love doing, have at it. But I will not be joining you. I hate meditating. I hate sitting still, concentrating on my breath. I hate closing my eyes and trying to push all the thoughts out of my head. I hate quieting my mind and settling my thoughts while my legs and arms are in positions that someone else tells me they need to be in. Trust me, I've tried. I've tried in the past on my own and in classes. I've tried with many of the books that Jolenta and I have lived by. The most notable of these was Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics by Dan Harris, Jeff Warren, and Carly Adler. Now, Jolenta figured that Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics would be the perfect book for me. Unlike The Miracle Morning, it didn't ask me to wake up at an ungodly early hour to meditate. And unlike other books we've lived by, it didn't ask me to meditate with the goal of getting rich or being more forgiving. I have zero belief that meditation can lead to the former, and I have no interest in doing the latter. On top of that, it was for skeptics like me, so it had to be a good fit, right? Wrong. For the 2 weeks we lived by the book, I did not find myself happier. Meditating made me more tense, not more calm. It made me aware of all the things I could or should be doing, rather than giving me a way to zone out. And on top of that, it connected me with the most single-minded, judgmental proselytizers I'd ever met. Whenever I told meditation lovers I wasn't enjoying meditation, they would insist I was doing it wrong. Whenever I said it wasn't for me, they'd say it was for everyone. Whenever I said I'd tried it dozens of times and still didn't like it, they'd say I needed to try it hundreds of times before I would. Everyone hates it at first, I'd be told. But eventually, after many hours, you will reach a place of peace. Here's the thing. I'm already a pretty peaceful person. I raise my voice only when people are about to walk into traffic or about to hurt me. I very rarely spiral into negative or anxious thoughts, and I'm great at living in the moment. Eavesdrop on me as I walk down the street, and you'll find me talking to each squirrel and smelling each flower as I revel in the feeling of the wind on my face. I'm fully in the moment. And when I'm meditating, I'm not. I'm wishing I was walking down that street with those flowers and squirrels, or dreaming of seeing friends, or laughing about something funny that happened to me that day, or maybe just drifting off to sleep. I'm doing none of the things with my brain that meditation says I should be doing, and when I try to guide my brain back to what I'm being told to do, I'm not having fun. I have a few theories about why I don't like meditation. One of these theories comes from my friend Eric Sasson. As he sees it, I'm wired like a good-natured wind-up doll. Each morning, I wake up fully wound and ready to do a million things. I march around, happy and productive and playful. And then as the day winds down, so do I. And then I go to sleep and let my body and mind restore themselves. And the next morning, I wake up fully wound again. As Eric says, you do, and then you sleep, and you get all the energy and restoration you need from those two things. You're just not wired for meditation. Another theory I have is that meditation might be better suited to people who are trying to tackle specific challenges that, fortunately, aren't a regular part of my life. For example, Dan Harris began meditating as a way to treat his anxiety and addiction issues. Other people, he points out, use meditation to manage their feelings of rage or to help them develop impulse control. Perhaps if these were ongoing issues in my life, I'd love meditation. But since they rarely are, meditation tends to feel like surgery for an ailment I don't have. And as our original By the Book producer Cameron Drews once said, nothing makes Kristen as unhappy as a book that tries to fix something in her that's not broken. A final theory I have about my dislike for meditation is related to my identity and personal history. As a woman of color, who also happens to be an abuse survivor, I've been told way too often in my life that being quiet and being still will make things better, when that absolutely has not been the case. And I abhor the idea of self-styled gurus telling me otherwise, especially when those gurus are white men whose books I've had to live by. What's empowered me most in life has been speaking out and standing up. What's made me feel less afraid and more in control is being anything but quiet. And what's made me feel more connected with each moment has been getting out of my head and more into the world around me. Whatever the reasons, I don't like meditation. Jolenta is a slightly different story. When we lived by Harris's book, she did see some real improvements in her life. When she found her anxiety or anger leading to negative thought spirals, she'd pause and say her newly adopted mantra, "I'm a queen bitch, and I got this shit on lock." And doing so would help derail her normal thinking patterns and reset her mind. When she felt the need to practice more compassion, the exercises in the book helped her tap into that part of herself. And when she wanted permission to relax, the book's lazy meditations, which can be done on the sofa in front of the TV, put her in a state of bliss. That being said, Jolenta also found that some of the book's exercises frustrated her, bored her, and made her physically uncomfortable. Note to everyone out there, some meditation postures are super stiff-making. She didn't love everything about meditation. She certainly didn't see it as the be-all, end-all solution for humanity. And boy, did she get tired of hearing from all the meditation zealots who kept insisting it was the solution for all the world's problems. Of course, if you're a meditation zealot, or even only a meditation dabbler, I just want to reiterate, you are free to meditate. I hope it brings you joy. But it's not for me, and it's only sometimes for Jolenta.
Dear Kristen and Jolenta, you're just wrong about meditation. It is being introduced to some schools and hospitals and prisons because it really helps people stay centered during stressful and often life-threatening situations. It helps to cut down on violence and anxiety. If you don't like to meditate, you just don't like science. KW. Dear KW, I totally agree with you and science. The benefits of meditation are real. And if it works well for you, that is awesome. I'm jealous. For Kristen and me, it felt taxing and frustrating as opposed to enriching. And while we may be in the minority, we aren't going to stress too hard because I think we've found other ways to get the benefits of meditation in our lives. Kristen loves walking through the city to get into a state of flow before work. I love to center my mind by crocheting at night. We have our ways, and even if they aren't as powerful as simply sitting our butts down and meditating, they work for us. Also, if you want an expert's opinion, here's a letter from a clinician listener on the subject. I'm a clinical psychologist, and I practice and teach mindfulness meditation. From my experience of my own mindfulness practice, I see amazing benefits to meditation. But I would still query the assertion that everyone needs to meditate. There are two things I think most people need to have in their lives, and mindfulness meditation can be a great way to get them, but it is by no means the only way. Thing one, the ability to shift into a being state of mind, present in the moment instead of always and only existing in doing mode. Doing mode isn't necessarily getting stuff done, but distraction and overthinking and disappearing into the past and future and hypotheticals and worries and obsessions. A being state of mind is being fully engaged in the present moment. Thing two, the ability to step back from your thoughts and emotions, notice what's going on, notice patterns, and what does and doesn't work for you, and make decisions about how to respond or make changes without feeling overwhelmed. Some people just do this naturally. Most people have some way of doing this through journaling or painting or talking with a supportive person who can say, hey, you've got caught up in that same thing again. Let it drop. I don't want anyone to think that if they can't spend 2 hours a day opting out of normal life to meditate like Dan Harris does, they have to miss out entirely on something that is available to everyone and for free. E. Angelenta. Admit you're a liar. When I was a little tyke of only 4, I was a big ol' liar. A blatant, Oshkosh-bagosh, overall-wearing, bald-faced liar. Whenever any adult at my play school asked my name, I told them it was Laura. Even at the tender age of 4, I knew my name was unique. Every time I introduced myself, I'd have to listen to a chorus of people saying things like, oh, what a different name. Wait, how do you pronounce that? Whoa, weird name. I was over being different after a few weeks of this. So I picked a beautiful, common, late 80s name, Laura, and started telling everyone who asked that that was what I was called. It was a lie. I knew the truth, picked a name that didn't correspond with said truth, and opted to tell people that non-truth. That is lying. Knowingly choosing to deceive someone. Lying to people usually isn't nice or worth it. When the truth comes out, the person who was lied to often feels betrayed and hurt, unless the lie is about a surprise party or present or something. Those are okay. But as I was saying, lying is a choice, and it usually makes everything worse. When I lied about my name, I embarrassed every other parent who went up to my mom asking if she belonged to Laura. And it could have been even worse than that. What if I got hurt or there was an emergency and the parent volunteer was frantically looking through the play school directory for Laura's emergency contact because little baby Jolenta wanted to lie that day? You catch my drift? Don't lie. It's not worth it unless you are lying about giving someone you love a cool-ass surprise. Why am I ranting about lying? Because self-help books love to call their devoted readers liars. The most blatant example of this came in season 4 when we lived by Rachel Hollis's book, Girl, Wash Your Face. Hollis grew up the youngest of 4 kids in a white, working-class, insular, evangelical Christian community. She describes her childhood as both sheltered and traumatic, and she was desperate to escape. So at the age of 17, she graduated from high school early and launched a new life for herself in Hollywood. Within her first 2 years there, she landed a job with Miramax, rubbed elbows with wildly famous people, and began dating the man who would eventually become her husband. Now, Rachel Hollis is the founder of her own event planning company, the creator of a hugely successful blog, and the author of several books. In Girl, Wash Your Face, Hollis insists that her trajectory can be replicated if we simply choose to be happier and stop lying to ourselves. And she insists that if we're unhappy, it's our own fault. To illustrate her point, she lists chapter by chapter the 20 biggest lies she used to tell herself and the way those lies kept her from being her happiest self. Along with those lies, she lists the steps she took to rewrite a happier script for herself, steps that she insists we can all take on our journeys to greater joy. The lies she lists include the following. Happiness comes from outside factors. I'll never be good enough. I'm always right. My love life defines my self-worth. I'm a bad mom. I'm not smart enough. I'm not sexy. I won't be worthy of love until my body is the right size. My trauma defines me. I need to drink, do drugs, or self-destruct to cope with life. I need someone to come save me. This list is full of self-destructive sentiments. I'll give it that. Holding on to these negative beliefs will definitely detract from anyone's quality of life. And these mean things should not be believed or adhered to if you want to enjoy life and not hate yourself. But here's the thing. These are categorically not lies we've made up to tell others or ourselves. This isn't like randomly choosing to start telling people your name is Laura when really it's Jolenta. It's not our fault these false and denigrating beliefs have seeped into our brains and inserted themselves as hard and fast rules. We didn't arbitrarily choose these lies that hold us back from enjoying ourselves and our lives. Picking up self-limiting beliefs isn't the same as strolling through a meadow and plucking any passing flower that catches your eye. I think it's a bit more complicated than that. These lies are instilled by society. Our cultural value systems are often invented by advertising, large corporations, and consumerism. And they implant these self-doubts and false truths in our heads. And they've done this for one simple reason, if you ask me. To prey on our insecurities to get us to buy more things to fix all the problems they say we have. You didn't create these lies that rotate through your head, denigrating you every day. These lies were presented as truth by the powers that be. You are not stupid for buying into them and perpetuating them. I truly don't believe any book should blame you for being influenced by lies instilled in you by others. How dare any book have the balls to give us a hard time for buying into the lies constructed by others and presented to us as truths? That's literally victim blaming. Telling people they are responsible for the social inequities and biases that hold them back in life is just another way of keeping oppressed people down and in no way promotes self-care or living life to the fullest. It's also pretty lazy advice. From what I can see, Hollis found what worked for her and then generalized that advice, saying it could help anyone from any walk of life. And obstacles that she'll probably never encounter as a white, straight, conventionally attractive woman are written off as self-limited thinking. This insidious message pops up in many other books, too. I touched on this when I was talking about The Miracle Morning, a book that insists the best way to start your journey to self-betterment is to admit you're a mediocre person. When Kristen and I were living by Mark Manson's best-selling book, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, the first step we had to take towards giving zero fucks was to take responsibility for everything that's occurred in our lives, regardless of whose fault it was initially. According to Manson, we don't always control what happens to us, but we can always control how we interpret what happens to us, as well as how we respond. It's that simple. The more we choose to accept responsibility in our lives, the more ownership we're supposed to feel. Fuck this notion! Not only is blaming yourself for the actions and beliefs of others super depressing, but Kristen and I have also found it to be quite self-destructive. We came head-to-head with this blamey self-help theme when we live by the Four Agreements by Don Miguel Ruiz. In the book, Ruiz lays out four rules or agreements to live by. These agreements help us see the self-limiting beliefs that hold us back from joy and push us toward freedom, true happiness, and love. The second agreement that Ruiz recommends we all live by is this: don't take anything personally. He says what others do is not because of you, it's because of them. Because of this, it should not be important to you if other people think you're the most magical sparkle pony in the world or the smelliest of all the garbage people. How people react to you isn't your problem either. If you living your life makes someone say, "You're hurting me," that's on them because they're letting themselves be hurt by you. Although I take things personally, like all the time, when I first read this, I was on board. Taking things personally does feel bad, and I don't like feeling bad. And often it really just is miscommunication. But then I started looking at what taking things personally gets done. It changes laws. It changes lives. Protests and movements come from groups of people taking injustice personally. It felt like more advice that existed to oppress the already disenfranchised. The thing I hated most about this step was watching how it hurt Kristen. She hated this advice more than anything else we've encountered while living by a book. Kristen is the amazing, joyful, inspirational, seemingly perfect person she is because she's worked really hard to understand that any pain inflicted on her during her childhood was not her fault. This step was asking her to undo all of this hard work and blame herself for being a helpless child, one who was never asking for the abuse that came her way. What a cruel task to advise in the name of wellness. I think we take things personally because they are, in fact, personal. Even when they aren't intended to be, who cares? Damage has been done, whether the perpetrator meant to inflict it or not. I'm sick of feeling ashamed for this whole "it's only business" lie. Everyone has feelings, and everyone takes things personally sometimes. What if the time we spent punishing ourselves for feeling feelings were put to a better use? Perhaps that energy could be spent on personal healing or considering the feelings of others. Personally, I'd rather try to learn from my pain and maybe prevent others from feeling similar ills than blame myself for the random acts that have hurt me throughout my life. The whole time we were living by the four agreements, I kept thinking about that PE teacher I had in high school who tortured me by ridiculing my body and manhandling me. That felt awfully personal. It definitely personally affected me. And I have every right to take it however I want. In fact, it was freeing to say how much I took it personally instead of telling myself I'm dumb for being bothered when a person in a position of power took his garbage out on a powerless kid. Any advice that tells you it's your fault you were fed lies about your worth and lovability is bad advice. And for people like Kristen, who have busted their asses to move past trauma and abuse at the hands of family members and authority figures, this advice can be re-traumatizing. As Kristen wrote in her verdict when we lived by the four agreements, it's insane to expect people to open all their old wounds back up and then say, hey, it's not the abuser's fault. He didn't know any better. You're never to blame for things beyond your control that hurt you or put self-deprecating beliefs in your head without your consent. The societal inequities, racism, body shaming, sexist beauty standards, and other roadblocks put in place to maintain social and economic structures are to blame. Most of these lies have been around in some form or another for generations, so no advice book should ever tell its readers to shoulder the responsibility for these boring old lies. Instead of blaming ourselves for the deception of others, I wish more books helped us explore how to get to the root of the self-limiting stories we tell that hold us back. Maybe then we can find the actual root of that lie, get mad at it, and pull it out like the gross weed that it is. But also, please don't lie.
Dear Kristen and Jolenta, I just want to point out that authors like Rachel Hollis come from an evangelical Christian background, and in evangelical Christianity, it's vital that we acknowledge our own sins, wrongdoings, and yes, lies. Doing so is the first step to being a better person. Repentance is central to the faith. EC. Dear EC, we're absolutely not opposed to repentance. We all do things wrong with other people's feelings and with our own responsibilities. Why, just yesterday, I got short-tempered with my husband, not because he'd actually done something offensive, but because I was hungry and grouchy. And of course, afterward, I apologized, because when we behave badly, we absolutely should repent. For more of our thoughts on this, please see our chapter, Offer Gracious Apologies. That being said, Jolenta and I also believe there's a difference between being repentant when we've done something wrong and using I'm a big fat liar as the jumping off point for improving our lives. It's blamey, it's judgy, and depending on how we look at things, it's very likely not true. Too many self-help authors, both Christian and not Christian, do this. And when they do, it's hard to feel as though they're not nagging us. In other words, breaking us down only so that they can build us back up, and then selling us a boatload of expensive online classes, life coaching, and conferences afterward. In the case of authors who call on their religion in the process, it can also feel blasphemous, disingenuous, and predatory toward those of the same faith. Of course, it's possible that some of these authors genuinely do see themselves as liars and absolutely believe they must admit their lies in order to enter the kingdom of heaven. If that's the case, fine. We don't want to take their religion away. And EC, we don't want to take yours away either. But Jolenta and I aren't part of the same faith community, and we won't be going around calling ourselves liars anytime soon. Kristen. Go on a diet. I'm going to say something completely unscientific right now that I 100% believe to be true. If diets really and truly made people happy, every woman in America would have been happy many times over before reaching the legal drinking age. That's because we've all been on diets, or been told to go on diets, or had diets explained to us or advertised to us on a loop from the time we were old enough to absorb information. For me growing up, the message was unrelenting, especially from the people who loved me. My mother and aunts were constantly on fad diets, from the grapefruit diet to the cabbage soup diet to the white rice diet to every major brand name packaged food diet. When they managed to drop a few pounds, they celebrated. When the weight inevitably came back, they'd lament. Not long after, they'd find a new diet to follow. Nana, while not technically a dieter, was always very persnickety about her weight and others' weights. She got on the scale each morning. She prided herself on wearing the same dress size her whole adult life. She constantly commented on people's figures and problem areas, whether those people were on TV or at the grocery store. The women in her own family heard her commentary the most. A week rarely went by without her saying, "Are you really going to eat all that?" Like a lot of people who grew up in a household like mine, I realized very early that my weight was something to fixate on and to fix. And popular media, from magazines to TV to toys, just drove this message home. I was supposed to hate my body. I was supposed to put in the work to make it lovable. The way to make it lovable was to restrict what I ate, but inevitably I'd fail and have to start over. And boy, did I do it well. From the time I was in third grade, I tracked what I ate and counted calories. I compared my body to those of other girls, including my wire-thin older sister, to whom I am not genetically related and thus have no reason to see as a realistic basis for comparison. I starved, then binged, then threw up. I smoked instead of eating, or I ate bags of food that I hid. I weighed myself a minimum of 3 times a day. During one spring in high school, I lost 30 pounds, which was nearly 25% of my body weight. The women in my family were thrilled. So was I. My food and body issues continued off and on through college. My weight fluctuated. My starving and binging and throwing up came in cycles. I tried diet pills and anything else I could get my hands on. And then I graduated from college and moved from Minnesota to New York. Gradually, I started to fixate less on my weight. Maybe the shift was because I was farther from the women in my family and their constant talk of weight. Maybe it was because I no longer owned a TV or had magazine subscriptions that yelled at me to be on a diet. Or perhaps it was because I suddenly had friends in a much wider variety of sizes who loved their bodies and whom I found beautiful. More than likely, it's also because I began talking at length with a counselor about the other reasons I'd felt bad about myself before heading to New York. I'm guessing it's also simply because I was so excited to be in a new place, starting a new life with a chance to be anything I wanted, including a million things more interesting than the number on a scale. And on top of all that, New York also gave me the chance to appreciate my body as much for what it did as for what it looked like. Every day, my legs took me up and down hundreds of subway stairs and across miles of city sidewalks. I really can't say for certain what put a halt to my dieting, my binging, my purging, and my constant obsession with my body. I'm guessing it wasn't any one thing. But I can say this. I was so much happier once I stopped fixating on my weight. I had so much more free space in my head when I wasn't constantly counting calories. The world felt bigger and richer when I gave it more attention than I did the size of my thighs. And more than anything, I felt an overwhelming sense of relief to be off the hamster wheel of failure. And yes, that's how I see diets, as a hamster wheel of failure. Diets don't take you to a destination. They keep you on the same cycle. Hate your body. Decide to fix your body by making it smaller. Go on a diet. When someone questions your diet, deny that it's a diet and explain that it's a lifestyle or eating plan. Lose a little bit of weight. Gain weight back after no longer being able to keep up with the diet. Feel like a loser. Start over. Note that part about lying about your diet. I think that's because deep down, we all know diets don't work. So we're not supposed to say we're on one. We're just naturally supposed to be skinny because skinny is better. Skinny means you're smarter. You're more worthy of love if you're skinny, more in control. Sure, tell that to my bulimorexic 17-year-old self. The truth is that there's no inherent value in being a skinny woman. I know this. Jolenta knows this. And in their hearts, I think most human beings know this. But diet books are everywhere, and in the spirit of trying to cover all the different kinds of self-help bestsellers, Jolenta and I once tried to live by a diet book. It was called French Women Don't Get Fat by Mireille Giuliano, and in the big wide world of best-selling diet books, it seemed as if it would be one of the least harmful. According to the blurbs, it was about embracing the joy of eating, not counting calories. It was about savoring tasty bites of good things rather than eliminating whole food groups. And above all, it wasn't about dieting. And so, when Jolenta and I had each put on a few pounds after the holidays during the first season, we decided to give the book a go. We knew people wanted us to try a diet book, and what harm could be done in 2 weeks? Turns out, a lot. We began with tracking what we ate. Every meal, every snack, and every beverage, and even though the book told us only to weigh our foods rather than track the calories in them, I found myself falling into all the old habits that tracking used to include for me. I began calculating every calorie, as well as every category of food that passed my lips. Was it a carb or was it a protein? Tracking foods soon morphed into tracking my activities. How many calories was I burning each day? Was I burning off enough? Maybe if I walked just 3 more miles. And of course, we weighed ourselves. The book says not to be a slave to scales, but we figured listeners would want to know what we weighed at the beginning and end of living by the book, and so we weighed in. But then I weighed myself a second time to make sure the number was right, and then again and again and again. Within a couple days, I was weighing myself dozens of times a day, including secretly when I found bathroom scales at friends' houses. Sure, it was obsessive, and it was exactly what the book told us not to do, but was weighing myself really that different from weighing my food? This was followed by what Marie Giuliano calls the tough weekend. The book instructed Jolenta and me to boil leeks and then consume the water the leeks were boiled in. If we got really hungry, we could eat some of the boiled leeks themselves. And if we got insanely famished, we could even dribble a tiny bit of olive oil on the boiled leeks. I didn't want to submit to the leeks or the oil. I wanted to be strong. But halfway through the tough weekend, I reached a breaking point. So rather than eat the leeks or the oil, I cheated by eating a lettuce leaf and 2 pickle slices. I began crying. I was barely into the book and already failing. When the tough weekend ended, we were again allowed to eat, but the diet was full of oil and dairy and meat, 3 things of which I'm not especially fond. Did I mention I don't like French food for the most part? I don't. Also, I'm lactose intolerant. And on top of that, the book instructed us to eat at times of the day when I usually don't and restrict food at other times when I usually do. Specifically, the book said we were required to eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner and forgo bedtime snacks. Now, I don't eat breakfast, and I never have. From the time I was very young, my preference has been to sleep in as late as possible, run out the door, and then, after building up an appetite for a few hours, eat lunch. In the evening, I eat dinner, and before bed, I usually have a bedtime snack of broccoli, popcorn, or something else that's crunchy. In other words, the book was asking me to upend my entire eating schedule. Suddenly, I had to wake up earlier and force-feed myself when I wasn't hungry. And once I started force-feeding myself, my appetite got weird. I was hungry all day long, every minute of the day, and my mind was constantly fixated on food, from what I ate to when I ate to how much I ate. And throughout all this, I was weighing myself as often as possible. Partway through week 1, I called Jolenta crying because I was in such despair about breakfast. She insisted that I just break the rules or modify them. Hey, I do it all the time. And in your case, all you have to do is rename your lunch, dinner, and bedtime snacks so they're called breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I did as she said, but I was still driving myself crazy. All I could talk about or think about was food. I had a crazed look in my eyes. I began building my entire life around what I could and couldn't eat. At the end of the first week, my husband called an intervention. He knew the book was doing very bad things to me. He begged me to quit. After many tears, we came to an agreement, which he didn't actually agree upon. I decided I would follow the book only in the loosest way possible. I felt a duty to finish it, if only partially, so that we could demonstrate to our listeners how damaging even the most healthy eating plans can be. I was committed, miserably so. As for Jolenta, she had a slightly easier time of things. Prior to the book, she had a habit of mindlessly eating entire boxes of cheese crackers in a single sitting. During the book, she checked in with her body more, noting when it was actually hungry and what it actually wanted to eat. But overall, the process was still needless torture for her. During the end of the tough weekend in particular, she cried with delight when she allowed herself a few drops of olive oil on her boiled leeks. Let's be clear. No one should be weeping with joy because they starved themselves for a whole weekend and then consumed 10 calories worth of oil. No one should be starving themselves in the first place. At the end of our 2 weeks, Jolenta and I each weighed in and found that we'd dropped a couple pounds. But despite experiencing a few benefits, Jolenta didn't feel the diet was healthy. And what I lost in weight was more than overshadowed by the trauma I felt during those 2 weeks, and in the weeks that followed. As we moved on to the next book, and the next book after that, I continued to track my food and weigh myself up to 50 times a day, sometimes getting up over 12 times in the middle of the night just to do so. And despite all the obsession, the weight came back. A few weeks later, I weighed more than I did when the whole experiment began. And of course, I felt horrible about myself. "Are you really going to eat all that?" I heard a voice in my head saying, a voice I'd quieted years before. What had I done to myself?
Dear Kristen and Jolenta, some of us really like to be healthy and fit. Some of us like to fit into our size 6 jeans. Some of us really do feel more confident in our bodies when we put our health first. GK. Dear GK, you do you. As long as you are doing things with and for your body and health that you love and that make your life better, I'm all for it. What I'm not for is using the word health as a way of holding bodies to unfair and often sexist, racist, or any other ist standards. As long as health and weight aren't considered synonymous, I am totally fine with health. I love that kind of health. The kind that doesn't assume skinny is true health and knows that weight doesn't reflect someone's moral failing or character strength in any way. That kind of health is great and keeps us alive. But I don't love it when I'm advised to fit into a certain size or look a specific way so society will call me good-looking. That's not health advice. That's just an annoying opinion I didn't ask for. Jolenta. Define people by gender. I've never considered myself to be good at relationships. The only real boyfriend I've had is the guy I ended up marrying. Before him, a very fun variety of long and short-term friends with benefits paraded through my life. Once Brad and I decided we were dating, I still sucked at relationships. I did so many rude, passive-aggressive, and ill-advised things that some days I truly marvel at the fact that we've managed to make a life together. Here's a list of things I did in my relationship that I would now advise against. Starting as friends with benefits on and off for a year. Kicking the person out of your house at 4 a.m. after hooking up and telling them, "I don't want my roommate to see you here, it's too embarrassing." Breaking into the person's email to read correspondence with people they dated before you two were exclusive. Fighting with the person while cooking Thanksgiving dinner and throwing the whole pot of stuffing you're making onto the stovetop out of rage. Working up the courage to agree to move in with the person only while coming out of anesthesia after surgery. Secretly trying on the engagement ring the person is hiding from you in their bedside table to check the size, seeing it's too small and dropping a billion hints about your finger size before they pop the question. Needless to say, when we decided to read a best-selling book about communication in relationships, I was stoked. Men Are from Mars, Women Are from Venus by John Gray is one of the best-selling relationship advice books ever written. It came out in the early 90s when I was around 6 years old. I saw this book on countless shelves and coffee tables and in baskets of reading material in the bathrooms of everyone's parents' houses. To me, it was a symbol of true adulthood. I figured that once I read it, I would finally be a real adult in a true grown-up relationship. And as I noted earlier, I needed all the help I could get to find more mature and functional ways of communicating with my partner. Sadly, this wasn't the result. Upon finishing the book, I was devastated. I ran to my now husband, Brad, fuming with rage, and the following exchange occurred. Me. This book is saying, just deal with it. Men are from Mars, like he's a Martian. While I'm saying, I expect human things from both of us, and I don't think I'm being... Brad. Unreasonable? Unreasonable. Unreasonable or one-sided or too much of a Venusian to expect you to live up to human expectations about living adult human lives. The book is all, do these quiet tricks and let him learn on his own. He'll fly when he's ready. But it's like, he's my husband. He's not my kid. He's not my baby bird. He's not Martian. It's letting men off the hook. I feel like the book is just saying, yeah, pretend to listen to her so she feels validated. But it doesn't say to actually validate her ever. It just says, give her the impression you're validating her and then do your own thing. Where I'm like, can't a woman get some validation? Do you see what I'm saying? Yeah. Do you feel like I'm mad at you or like lecturing you? Brad nods. I feel very shut down. Why? I'm just getting heated about this book. I'm not mad at you. because your takeaway from this book is Brad is wrong and I'm right. No, my takeaway is that women are always wrong. And like, no matter what you do, you have to cater yourself to men and like the way they deal with things, and you'll never be heard unless you change everything about yourself. Change everything? That's what it's saying. It's like the way you communicate is wrong, and of course you don't get what you want because you're an overbearing cunt. It's a disappointing book because I feel like it's just saying, Jolenta, you're wrong. When I feel my whole fight in our relationship is to feel heard and validated. And then this book comes in and stomps on that, implying I'm crazy for wanting my needs to be met. I agree. It doesn't give women enough credit. End scene. Instead of groundbreaking advice on how to clearly communicate my wants, needs, fears, and so on to my partner, or tips for controlling my anger, the book was full of super sexist pointers based on the idea that men and women are completely different species, and in fact, aliens from two different planets. It has chapter after chapter excusing men, saying they're naturally shut down and conversation averse and shouldn't be expected to process or express emotions. I find that generalization of this kind is rarely helpful. To me, it reads as an acrobatic theory used to imaginatively gloss over the fact that all humans are unique regardless of gender, which is a social construct anyway, or any other idea that's popularly used to marginalize populations. It's easier to say, nature made us like this, than it is to say, oh, weird, why do we seem to be socializing half our population to see working through emotions as weakness? It seems like this low expectation of maturity hurts those around them. I want to investigate the problems I face in life and in my relationship. I do not want these problems reasoned away with sexist ideals. And surprise, sexist advice doesn't just pop up in books about relationships. In Pick 3, Randy Zuckerberg posits the idea that pretending to have it all while actually strategically balancing too many tasks behind the scenes is the answer for women to find fulfillment. When Kristen and I read this, we were disappointed that the book never really addresses the root of where these unfair expectations to have it all even come from. Why not acknowledge that society tends to expect more of women? Women should be perfect homemakers, ultra-supportive of their spouses, involved parents, and employees who work as though they have no obligations waiting for them at home. Advice about how to fake having all these things under control just furthers the problem. And maybe I'm naive, but I want my self-help to help a lot more than that.
Dear Kristen and Jolenta, I'm a baby boomer woman, and maybe it's just my generation, but men and women really are different. We were raised differently. We were taught to communicate differently. We were brought up with different social expectations and trained from day one to take on different roles. Considering all this, aren't men and women, at least in my generation, inherently different? OP. Dear OP, we are all products of our environments and times. And yes, the time you grew up in was rife with hard and fast rules about what constituted a real man versus a real woman. Some of these roles are hard to move past. Some are so ingrained it can feel hard to distinguish between what's inherent and what's socially constructed. On top of that, even if you want to move past the gender roles you were raised with, you may find that other people around you don't. They may prefer that you stay the way you are, and they may want to stay the way they are as well. That being said, people change all the time, and society changes all the time, and even if we feel we're in a static, unmoving version of the world, we're not. Perhaps, OP, you attended a school in which girls always wore skirts and never trousers, but now you yourself are very comfortable wearing either. Perhaps you know a man your age who was raised to think cooking was for women, who now loves nothing more than making a good stir fry. Change usually comes so slowly we don't see it happening, but it does happen. One last thing. While the world treats gender as a given, it's not. Yes, we're born with the sexual organs we're born with, but those organs do not automatically mean that we'll identify as a specific gender. There are people with testicles who identify as women. There are people with vaginas who identify as neither a man nor a woman. Gender and gender roles are complex, and even if they feel like it, they're never inherent. Kristen. Forgive. A very large percentage of the books we've lived by have suggested that practicing forgiveness is essential to feeling happy and at peace. These books usually say that forgiveness is something we should do for ourselves, not for the people who did us wrong. By our forgiving, they insist, our wrongdoers will no longer take up space in our psyches and will be released from the shackles of the past. According to these books, forgiveness can take a variety of forms. In many cases, it's letting go of all the anger and pain we feel over being mistreated. In others, it's an act of absolution. Still others equate it with gratitude, as in, we can thank those who've hurt us because they played a role in making us who we are today. And in the case of Don Miguel Ruiz's The Four Agreements, it's making a concerted effort to see things from our abuser's point of view. Abused children are advised to acknowledge that their abusers were victims of their own upbringing, and thus, not at fault for their actions. What I say to all this is, hell's no. And what Jolenta says can't be heard by the human ear because the sound of a woman skipping past a step that says forgive, which is what she almost always does, is just that quiet. Let's start with the pain and anger part. When bad things happen, I think people should feel pain and anger. The victim should, and the victim's loved ones should. Pain and anger are natural responses to injuries, both emotional and physical, and when we pretend we don't feel these emotions, we're in denial at best, or sociopaths at worst. As I see it, anger gets a bad rap. There are many situations that justify it, and many situations in which anger pushes us toward greater action, like fighting for racial equality, or repealing laws that hurt women, or working harder to protect children, or walking away from people who are horrible to us. To be clear, I'm not talking about rageaholic levels of vitriol that manifest in irrational acts of violence. I'm not talking about carrying around a fury so great that it's all you can think about most days. But in self-help books, we're often told that anger in any amount is dangerous, even a low-grade anger that sits mostly dormant 10 levels beneath the surface. According to these books, any amount of anger eats us up and prevents us from being the best versions of ourselves. Call me cocky, but I think I'm a pretty great version of myself. And I think Jolenta's top-notch as well. And we both have some anger. I have anger toward that former friend who repeatedly tried to get it on with my then-boyfriend a few years ago. Jolenta has anger toward the PE teacher who harassed her all through high school. And I most certainly have anger toward my father and his wife, who did all sorts of violent and disgusting things to me growing up. It's not the kind of anger we feel most weeks or even months, but it kicks in when we see someone else being hurt. If you want to see Jolenta get all mama bear, just hurt someone she loves. And I certainly feel it when I find myself in situations where I could be in danger. I consider it handy. Let's move on to the form of forgiveness that's also called absolution. I'm totally okay with this form of forgiveness in most day-to-day interactions. For example, if someone accidentally steps on my toes on the subway and apologizes, I'm absolutely going to say, no worries, or that's okay. Same goes for someone calling me the wrong name, or showing up 5 minutes late, or breaking a wine glass, or making any number of other accidental mistakes. We all make mistakes. Who cares? But when we're talking about enormous transgressions, I'm not going to say that's okay, or no worries. It's not okay if you deliberately cause physical or emotional injuries to me or someone I love. It's not okay if you take my rights away because of my gender or race. It's not okay if you dehumanize me or other humans. And I certainly won't say, no worries, if you've instilled a horrible sense of worry in me over my own worth. Example, are you someone who repeatedly told me I was useless in my most formative years? If so, I'll never say, no worries, to you. There are a few arguments for the absolution model of forgiveness. One of them is the belief that if you say, you're forgiven, or it's okay, or no worries,